From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Jurors are deliberating for the second day in the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. We'll continue to watch that story as we await a verdict. Also today, the tensions between President Trump and the intelligence community are escalating after the president's decision to revoke the security clearance for former CIA Director John Brennan. Retired Navy Admiral William McRaven wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post yesterday saying it would be an honor to have the president revoke his security clearance, too.
It's Friday, so let's bring in our roundtable. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
Hey, and Abby Phillips, CNN White House correspondent. Hi, Abby. It's good to have you back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's start, Abby, with Admiral McRaven, who said if President Trump revoked his clearance, it would add his name to the list of men and women who have spoken out against the president. This coming from a man, by the way, who led the Navy SEAL raid that killed Osama bin Laden. What kind of weight is that carrying today?
Well, I think it's carrying quite a bit of weight because he's one of those people. Now it seems there are fewer and fewer of those people, but one of those people who in a past life would rarely, if ever, speak up about a current administration. These are military leaders who typically stay in their lane. They don't get involved in partisan politics. They don't criticize current officials or former officials. And the fact that he's speaking up when we haven't really heard much from him yet is really turning the spotlight on this issue. But it's particularly important because it stands in contrast to what's not happening, which is that the president is not getting a lot of pushback on his decision to revoke these clearances from his own party. So it has really fallen to people like McRaven and a former national security officials to speak out about this.
Well, he is getting some pushback from some members of his party, including Lindsey Graham, who was yesterday on Fox News. Let's hear that.
You can be the former CIA director and a critic of the president. You just can't lead the resistance movement at the same time. If you look at CIA policy about how a former director should act, he is well over the line.
So he's getting support from Lindsey Graham. Domenico, it's worth pointing out as well that there is another former intelligence official who stands against the move, and that is the former director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. Let's hear him on CNN.
The larger implication here is the jeopardy to our First Amendment rights, and by extension, others. And by the way, there's a very chilling message here to people in the intelligence community. If you tee up intelligence that the president doesn't like, you may risk losing your clearance and thereby your job.
Domenico, is this a tempest within the intelligence community, or do you think James Clapper is right that it could have a much broader ramification on, for instance, law enforcement?
Well, I mean, I think that the president is somebody who's gone after some of these pillars of democracy, like the free press, like judges, and now you're seeing with national security and intelligence apparatus. You know, I think that there are a lot of people who, you know, would feel that this president is going too far, coming from people like Clapper and Brennan. And the president, though, would say that they are critics. You know, like you heard from Lindsey Graham there saying, you know, they shouldn't be speaking out the way they are against the president. It's not typical, right? It's the way Brennan's speaking is not typical. The way James Clapper is speaking is not typical. But this is not a typical president either, is what they would point out. So we're having this sort of in the moment discussion about protocols and what's appropriate and what's not, really from the president on down to members of the intelligence community. They really feel like this is an attempt to muzzle them. And some of them are saying they don't need these security clearances anyway to speak out. And the president says, hey, I'm not trying to shut anybody up. They can go on as many shows as they want.
And Abby, we're going to keep talking about this because the president is saying or hinting that he wants to keep doing this. Who else is in his crosshairs here?
Oh, that's exactly right. There are nine people that Sarah Sanders announced at the podium earlier this week that they were considering revoking their clearances. But it seems, according to President Trump himself, that at the top of that list is a man named Bruce Orr, who is a current Justice Department official, who the president has been tweeting about for days now about his connection to the Russia probe, suggesting that he was conflicted from the start. And the president basically said today that he believes that Orr's clearance might be revoked, quote, soon. So I would imagine that he might be next. And that would be actually, I think, really important because Orr, unlike everybody else on that nine-person list, is actually a current official. He is not a former official. And to our knowledge, he has not spoken out in the same way like like John Brennan has. And so it would be a different kind of action on the president's part. It would be one that was very much directed at these folks who are running the Russia probe or were responsible for originating the Russia probe during the 2016 campaign.
You know, or as somebody who runs the organized crime unit and is – all of this seems to be coming back to Russia, as Abby notes. You know, President Trump went and talked about that with the Wall Street Journal, sort of completely undermining the rationale that Sarah Sanders once again had at the podium. And he went and said, look, these are people who started the Russia probe. The whole thing is a witch hunt. It's a scam. It's rigged and all that. And he wants this thing over with. You know, I really wonder once the 2018 elections are over with, what kind of action we're going to see from this president.
You know, some people think they can't wait until these issues around Omarosa Manigault-Newman are over with, the former Trump aide who is now on a book tour. We've been getting a lot of back and forth between her and the administration. The New York Times is now reporting that she may have as many as 200 tapes containing information about the Trump administration. Here's a bit from the latest tape where the president's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, allegedly offers Omarosa a $15,000 a month job to join the Trump's reelection campaign. This is just after she was fired from the administration in 2017.
It sounds a little like, obviously, that there's something you've got in the back pocket to pull out. Clearly, if you come over with the campaign, like, we can't have, we gotta.
Oh, God, no.
Everybody's positive, right?
Saying that everything has to be positive, she joins the reelection campaign. You know, the media are all over these tapes, but I wonder in the bigger picture, given that we don't really know how many tapes there are and what's on them, how important they are.
Well, I think they are quite important because, frankly, this is a situation where you have people on all fronts who have serious credibility issues, including Omarosa. And to the extent that there is hard evidence of things that may or may not have happened, it adds to what we can say we know. That being said, these tapes, we don't know all of the context surrounding them. I think in some cases, the news organizations who've obtained them may know more than they release, but it's really critical that we have something that is like even somewhat objective here, because you have people like Omarosa who've said one thing one day and then another thing another day, folks in the Trump orbit who are putting out statements that are simply untrue. And given that environment, I think as reporters, we have to kind of push for whatever we can hold in our hands or see with our own eyes or hear with our own ears.
I was just going to say, you have unreliable narrators on all sides of this. You don't know who to believe, right? I mean, the president says something, maybe it turns out to be not so true. Omarosa says something and, you know, you can't quite believe everything she's telling you.
And Domenico,
so
I
these
point
tapes
out,
are so important.
Yeah, and I want to point out it's the exact same situation. We've had this conversation over and over again in the Paul Manafort trial, whether or not we can who's telling the truth here, Paul Manafort or Rick Gates? I mean, so it seems to be a trend within the people who have had for people who've had ties to the administration that we don't know who's telling the truth here.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of a difference with the Manafort trial. I mean, this is, you know, the government bringing a serious case against somebody for their financial alleged financial crimes. I mean, you know, they have documented proof. It's not just what Rick Gates is saying. It's whether or not a jury will believe the documents, the fact that he didn't have he didn't declare foreign bank accounts, that he didn't pay taxes on some $60 million. You know, none of that is necessarily the same as saying we have people that we can't believe in a he said, she said kind of deal. There's some actual proof there. And that's why the tapes are important, too, because when you can't believe the people involved, you need as much primary source evidence as you can get.
Okay. Abby, let's talk about the Democrats. Interesting developments this week with House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi under a lot of pressure from members of her own party to step aside even before the midterm elections. In fact, one of her longtime allies, James Clyburn, said he would be ready to step up if somehow Pelosi doesn't get the support she needs. Where are we on this internal struggle within the Democratic Party?
Well, it's an ongoing saga. We've actually been talking about this for quite some time now. Pelosi has been facing some pressure on among her Democratic colleagues to step aside to let a younger generation come forward. Interestingly, Clyburn is not exactly a younger generation.
No, he's 80 years old.
He's actually not the opposite of that. And so it illustrates the whole problem for Democrats, because there really are a lot of Democrats who are on the younger side. People like Seth Moulton, who are pushing Pelosi to step aside for a younger generation. But then there is an older generation of Pelosi's colleagues who are around her in leadership, but also may want her to step aside so they can have their moment in the sun. All of this adds up to some pressure on her. But right now, going into the midterms, I think Democrats are having this conversation. They're happy to have it, but they want Pelosi to continue to raise money for them. And at the end of the day, they know that once the chips, they have to wait and see what happens in the midterms before they determine this.
And there have been reports that Nancy Pelosi, that as many as 40 people, Democrats running and within Congress, who might not vote for her, still she's the lock, almost guaranteed to be the next speaker if Democrats take over, even though her popularity has gone down even among Democrats.
That's NPR's Domenica Montanaro and CNN's Abby Phillip. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
200 years ago, Mary Shelley published Frankenstein, which is widely considered the scariest book ever written. NPR is celebrating that masterpiece with a horror-themed summer readers poll. Listeners nominated their favorite spine chillers, a panel of experts then weighed in, and the list of the scary 100 is now up, and we're going to link you to it at hereandnow.org. Petra Mayer is an editor with NPR Books. Petra, thanks for speaking with us.
Always a pleasure.
There's a little rumor going around here that you're kind of a scaredy cat, so I just want to make sure you're okay with this assignment.
Rumor, my pale, shivering hiney. That's not a rumor. I'm very upfront about the fact that I'm a gigantic horror wuss.
Okay, so you had to read a lot of horror. And let's start with the most famous one on the list, probably Frankenstein, 200 years old, in many ways just as scary today as it was in 1818. What did Mary Shelley get right about horror?
Well, I think she nailed an essential fear and a thing that was happening in 1818 as much as it is today, because the crux of Frankenstein, right, is the idea that human ingenuity, human achievement, human technological advancement is far outstripping our responsibility or our ability to control the technology. You know, she was writing around the time of the Industrial Revolution. Now we're in an era where technology is just racing ahead of our ability to legislate or even to think about everything that's going on. I mean, that's a fear that never really goes away. As long as science is advancing, Frankenstein will be with us.
Okay, so relevant today, it also, of course, inspired this reader's poll, which we want to make clear. This is not a ranked list, and it's also not a list of listener favorites. So, I mean, what is it? How did you do this?
What it is it's a curated list that's a combination of listener nominations and input from our panel of expert judges. We open up the polls for people to nominate their five favorite titles in whatever genre we're doing. And then we take those thousands and thousands of votes and I kind of whittle them down to semi-finalists. That's a list of about 250. That goes to the judges. And then we have this super epic conference call where we all get on the phone and it takes hours. This year, actually, it was 2.5 hours, which is our record speed. And we cut that list down to usually about 75, and then we build it back up again with input from the judges so that there's more balance and interest and it can be a real tool for discovery. And then that final list of 100 is what you'll see on the page.
Okay, and I'm making an educated guess here, but I am thinking that the name Stephen King came up quite a bit.
Oh boy, did it. Yeah, so we got close to 7,000 votes, and I counted. Stephen King was 1,023 of them.
Wow.
Yeah. So in past years, we've kind of, because it's a list of only 100, we tend to not want people on the list more than once. A few years ago, we did the romance poll. We asked people for their favorite romance novelist, and Nora Roberts, who's pretty much the Stephen King of romance, got on the list twice. We coined the Nora Roberts rule for her. So this year, it's the Stephen King corollary. We're allowing authors on the list to have one novel and one short story, because so much horror is in short story format. So for Stephen King, the book of his that got the most votes was The Shining. And then the judges decided that his most representative story was The Body, which of course is the basis for Stand By Me.
Really? Now that's interesting, because The Body, it's been a few years since I've read it, isn't a typical piece of horror.
No, it's not. And I will say right now also that a lot of things on the list are not straight horror. There are things that have a toe in horror or are commenting on horrors. But yeah, it's not really what you would consider a horror story. Although when I asked the judges, Grady Hendrix said something along the lines of, well, it's got a dead body in it and it's about how scary it is to grow up. So
yeah, true.
That's horror. I mean, we have a whole category for real world horrors, right?
Okay, what about another name on the list here? H.P. Lovecraft. I did a little bit of research on this writer before we spoke. Not a great guy. In fact, he was outwardly racist. Why did you decide to include him?
Yeah, sure. Lovecraft was gross. Lovecraft was a bigot even by the standards of his own time. But he is also foundational to modern horror. In past years, we have actually cut people from the list because their work did not stand the test of time. In this case, I was guided by the judges, and they felt that it was important to include Lovecraft because there are a lot of authors today who are in conversation with him. I mean, first of all, he created a cosmology that became an entire genre, Lovecraftian horror, cosmic horror, the idea of elder gods and scary things from beyond the stars that drive you insane. I mean, that is a huge viable genre of modern horror. And there are authors, for example, Victor Laval, whose book The Ballad of Black Tom is on the list, who are taking Lovecraft's work. In the case of Victor Laval, he took a story called The Horror at Red Hook, which is a terrible story, and B, one of Lovecraft's most unrepentantly racist works. And he flipped it so that the horror comes from the racism, and he built something new and interesting and angry and strange with it. So I think because Lovecraft, I mean, we have to acknowledge how repellent his ideas are, but we also have to acknowledge that he's still a vital part of horror and that there are authors now who are building on him to create works that are really interesting and valuable.
Now, I know you had a bunch of interesting, great judges that helped you go through this long list of books, but I want to ask you personally, the scaredy cat in the room, what your favorite was?
This may not come as a surprise. It is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
the kids series.
The kids series. So the thing with this, though, it's not the stories themselves, which are kind of garden variety urban legends. You have to have the version with the original illustrations because those will hollow out your brain and live there. They're terrifying. They're these black and white watercolor blobby. If you see them, you'll know them. You probably saw these when you were a kid and they probably give you nightmares. They reissued the book a couple years ago with like updated cutesy illustrations. No. It's got to be the original.
All right. It's the NPR Summer Readers Poll with Petra Mayer of NPR Books. Petra, thanks for reminding me that there still is time this summer to read before the leaves start turning.
Absolutely. There's always time to read.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Speaking of horror stories, what happens to an alligator that loses its tail? For most, it's game over. But not for Mr. Stubbs. He is one lucky reptile. Mr. Stubbs has a new lease on life thanks in part to 3D printing technology. It took a team effort by researchers at the Core Institute in Phoenix and the Midwestern University to design a better kind of replacement tail for the alligator. Before 3D technology, they made a mold of an actual alligator's tail to fit it. That was pretty expensive. But now 3D technology has made it more practical. Daniel Marchand is executive curator at the Phoenix Herpetological Society's Reptile Sanctuary, where Mr. Stubbs resides. How are researchers constantly changing the design as he gets older?
They actually made three different versions of it. One was short and stubby, one was what they believe the correct length was, and one was actually made a little bit longer. So it gave them ability to try different things with the tail to see what the reaction would be in the things that would happen by changing some of the dimensions.
When you first got this 3D tail, or at least when you were able to put it on Mr. Stubbs, there was a bit of trial and error because there are different kind of tails that were produced. How did you know which one was the right one?
Based on his size and his weight, they basically took dimensions from alligators similar in size, so they had a really good idea of what it should have been. So they created a tail exactly to based off those dimensions, what they thought it should be, but then they wanted to play with the concept of what happens if the tail was a little bit shorter, what would it do, and if the tail was a little longer, what would it do?
Could you describe Mr. Stubbs for us?
Body length, without the tail, of course, he's about 4 foot body length, and before we received him, he was actually owned by a gentleman who had an illegal alligator facility, and he basically had purchased a new alligator, and it was smaller than his others, and he had placed it into an enclosure where the other alligators thought they were being fed something, and they actually bit off his original tail.
Mr. Stubbs is in the position he's in without a tail because of the act of illegal animal traffickers. What happened to them?
So the person that was in possession of Mr. Stubbs was basically given a citation for having him and without permit and proper stuff to do that.
So the first tails that he got, thanks to you guys, were made of what?
Actually, the material is called dragon skin, and they use it again in prosthetics with humans, is that it could be on the skin, against the skin, for very long periods of time and not cause irritation or uncomfortable feeling.
And how many of those has he gone through? Because as he grows, you have to keep making the tails bigger, right?
Correct. And as he grows, about every 12 to 16 months, we basically remeasure and reweigh him and see where we should be with this tail.
So has it made a difference for him?
He doesn't notice anything. Before he gets the tail, the engineers and the doctors and people behind this are having a much easier time getting to the point of getting that tail made.
And does he have to relearn how to swim when he gets a new tail like this one?
We were concerned that when we put something on him that now had weight behind it, that maybe he felt that he was being pulled on and he would want to turn around and basically bite his own tail because he didn't know what it was. So what we had to do is we had to see if he would know how to swim. So we actually would put him in our swimming pool and we would hold him down underwater. And then at the point where he needed a breath of air, he would basically wiggle his body, if you want to call it that, and he would make his way to the surface. So we basically gave him swimming lessons.
It's taking a lot of care, and he's probably a pretty happy camper at this point. Why is it worth it?
You know, we save animals every day, and this is a very special one to us. We've been able to do something that no one else has ever done. With a lot of things that we learn through medical procedures and things today, animals are where we get some of our basic information. Alligators, for example, are resistant to a lot of bacteria that humans are not. And there's a lot of research being done today to find out why alligators are resistant to bacteria that are very harmful to humans.
Nice to talk with you, Daniel.
Thank you very much for having me.
Daniel Marchand at the Phoenix Herpetological Society in Arizona.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Seattle measured its worst air quality in decades earlier this week after wildfires in British Columbia blanketed much of the Northwest in a smoky haze. And yesterday, Washington Governor Jay Inslee urged voters to approve a price on carbon that he said would curb air pollution. Many cities in the U.S. are still dealing with poor air quality, and not just because of these wildfires. A recent study says tens of millions of Americans regularly breathe polluted air, and that number is likely to grow in part because of climate change. Elizabeth Ridlington is a policy analyst with Frontier Group, an environmental advocacy group, and she's co-author of that study. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to talk about that study that you did in just a moment, but let's start with these fires and what they've done to air quality up and down the West Coast. We're seeing some local reports that air quality around Seattle was worse than major cities in China and India lately. Has it really been that bad?
Yes. The fine particulate pollution that comes off those wildfires can travel hundreds of miles, if not even thousands of miles. And so Seattle and other places up and down the West Coast, and then even as far as some East Coast cities, are experiencing significant pollution from these fires.
It's been a problem for a while, of course. Big picture, you studied air pollution data from 2016 for this report that we mentioned. And you write that in 2016, 73 million Americans experienced more than 100 days of air quality bad enough to harm human health. What is driving those numbers?
What's driving those numbers is our continued reliance on fossil fuels. So burning oil, diesel, natural gas, and coal creates pollution that forms into smog, also known as ground-level ozone, which is bad for human health.
I assume a lot of that is coming from things like automobiles, but aren't cars becoming more fuel efficient? Aren't they becoming cleaner?
Yes, cars are amazingly cleaner than they were 20 years ago, and that is a thing to be celebrated. But we also still need to continue making progress. There are a lot more cars on the road now than there used to be, and that's why we can't afford to rest on our laurels or even backslide on air quality standards for vehicles.
You made a list of the 10 most populated metro areas with more than 100 days of elevated air pollution in 2016. Tops on the list, Riverside, San Bernardino, Ontario, that's in California's Inland Empire east of LA. Las Vegas was on the list, Los Angeles. What does it mean for the people who live there, who, by the way, have known for a while that their air has not been great?
Right. Low levels of smog can make you cough or wheeze. It can feel like a sunburn in the lungs. It just does not feel good. Over the long term, it can cause asthma. It can trigger asthma attacks. It can also just cause permanent damage to the lungs.
Your data come from 2016, before the Trump administration, which, of course, as we know, we've been reporting on, has been trying to roll back quite a few environmental regulations, including those on fuel efficiency. Do you have any idea yet how the picture has changed since 2016?
Since 2016, air quality has probably largely held steady in terms of pollution from vehicles, but both 2017 and 2018 have had some significant wildfire events that have created a tremendous amount of fine particulate matter pollution. In terms of the Trump administration and going forward, the proposal to freeze fuel economy standards at current levels is very bad news for our long-term health and long-term air quality.
Elizabeth Ridlington is a policy analyst with the Frontier Group. Elizabeth, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
A federal judge in San Diego is holding a hearing today to determine whether parents deported under the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy should be allowed to return to the U.S. and be reunited with their children. The administration says there are hundreds of children between the ages of 5 and 17 who were separated from their parents at the Mexican border and who remain in the custody of the U.S. government. Shannon Dooling from member station WBUR introduces us to two of these families living in Honduras, waiting for the return of their children and depending on help from a stranger who lives thousands of miles away.
The Galvez family is sitting down to breakfast, wearing their Sunday best, looking out at the Caribbean Sea. To get where they are, in the coastal city of La Ceiba, took a four-hour bus ride and $40. They had to borrow the money from a friend. It's basically 6 months' worth of income. Jose Hector Galvez says he's barely able to keep his family fed, let alone repair the leaky, thatched roof of their home. In fact, it was the prospect of fixing the roof that led to their family being separated.
I left because work is impossible to find here. I left so I can help and support my family. That was the motivation for my trip. I never expected this to happen.
In May, Galvez and his 16-year-old daughter, Kenya, left for the U.S. The plan was to try and find work for a year or so, save some money, and return to Honduras to repair his home, where his wife and their two other children had stayed behind. After traveling by bus to the U.S.-Mexico border, Galvez explained to U.S. immigration officials that he and his daughter wanted work. He was told he would be deported immediately, and that his daughter would follow in a week or so. He says both he and his daughter were told to take off their belts and their shoelaces. He was placed in a holding cell with other men, while Kenya was kept with women and children.
What I was told is that I had to go to immigration court, and they said, Kenya's over there, and you can go talk to her. And I said, okay, I'll go explain to her that I have to go to court, but when I come back from court, she'll still be here. I can see her again. And they said, yes, you can. But that's not what happened. When I came back, she wasn't there, and I didn't know where she went.
At this point in her husband's story, Rosalina Linder, Kenya's mother, reaches for a washcloth she's brought with her and wipes her eyes. She says they feel hopeless. She's gotten no help from her own government, no help from the U.S. government.
Sí, no ha sido fácil. Pues yo como madre, pues me he sentido muy sola, muy triste.
As a mother, you feel this intensely. She says she feels physical pain, especially when she speaks to her daughter. She puts her hand on her heart. I feel it here, right here, she says. I worry intensely about her and I pray to God to bring her back safely to me. And she left with her father so that they could work, just so they can fix our little house.
Me pega ese dolor porque yo me preocupo por ella.
And then a few weeks ago, Linder got a phone call from a friend. The friend had seen a news story on television. A phone number flashed on the screen with a message that said, if you have children in U.S. immigration, call this number. And so I called and I said, please send me my daughter. She's the only daughter I have and she needs to be returned to me. It was Isabel Lopez, an immigrant advocate in Boston, who answered that phone call.
Bueno, queda, estamos en contacto, ¿oyó? Gracias, Diana.
Okay. It's so difficult to talk to this family right now.
Isabel Lopez puts her cell phone down on the table. She's sitting in a noisy Dunkin' Donuts in downtown Boston. Lopez is from Honduras, and her family still lives there. They told her no one in Honduras was talking about these parents trying to find their children.
And so one day I decided to call the TV station to let people know that, you know, that they can call me.
And whose number was given?
My number.
Lopez says she's spoken with nearly 70 families since she shared her cell phone number on Honduran television back in late July. Since then, she's created a database of names and numbers, families who are looking for their children. She's connecting some of these families with legal experts and buying international calling cards so they can try and track down their children. That's how the Galvezes wound up in La Ceiba, where they met with Boston-based immigration attorneys.
And it's painful, too. I cannot imagine having my kid being taken away from me. And like putting my hope in strangers over the phone with the language barrier, with the communication, and their kids calling them and saying, I don't want to be here. Every day, how can you live? How can you eat? How can you stay stable?
Back in Honduras, 33-year-old Carlos Alexis Hernandez Licona has been facing those questions every day for the last 3 months. He left his hometown of Olancho to look for work in the U.S. He brought with him his 6-year-old son, Carlos Gabriel. After traveling with a coyote to Mexico, he and his son shared an inner tube to cross the Rio Grande. He says they eventually walked into McAllen, Texas, and in May presented themselves to immigration officials.
I was placed in a cage. Eventually, I was moved into a bigger cage. ICE officers were near, and I confronted them, and I said, you're not going to take my son away from me.
But they did. His son ran to him. His son said to him, Dad, I want to stay with you. Don't let them take me away. But ICE did take his son away. Licona says he was there for 14 more days before he was deported back to Honduras. Licona says ICE never told him where his son was being taken or how long he would be held. He says he's still never been contacted by the U.S. government. So when he saw Isabel Lopez's phone number on television last month, he called right away. She offered him advice and helped him navigate what can be a very complicated immigration system, even for someone who speaks English. But for Licona, who only speaks Spanish and who cannot read, calling hotlines in the U.S. and finding help with paperwork can feel insurmountable. Licona eventually learned his son is being held in a facility in New York. He speaks with him once a week. He says his son mostly talks about coming home and asks how much longer he has to wait. Lacona tells him he'll be home soon.
Diana, Cristina. Entonces, mire, Diana, no, lo que pasa es que...
In Boston, Lopez is still answering phone calls from mothers and fathers who are looking for their children and putting their hope in a stranger. For Here and Now, I'm Shannon Dooling.
And Lisa, a little baseball history was made last night. The Texas Rangers turned a triple play without retiring the batter for the first time since like June 13th, 1912. Last night, David Fletcher was batting for the Los Angeles Angels. The bases were loaded and there were no outs, of course. Fletcher hit the ball to the left side of the infield. Here's the play-by-play.
Ground ball third. Profar will tag out the runner. Throw back to second. And now they've got a chance for the triple play. Yeah, they tagged out the runner Calhoun. And that's a triple play.
Ted Berg in USA Today writes that Rangers third baseman Jurickson Profar seemed to be the only one on the field who knew what he had started because he caught that ball on a short hop, and then he stepped on third base.
And that was the first out.
Right, that's the first out. Then he tagged out the runner who'd been on third and should have been running for home, which, of course, is the second out. And then Profar threw to his second baseman to force the runner out who was on first base. So you got three outs there, and the inning was over. A triple play that does not include getting the batter out is incredibly rare. Again, the last time that happened was in 1912 when the Brooklyn Dodgers did something similar against the Cincinnati Reds.
And the Rangers won the game, so it was a rare break. Great spot for the team that's very much in last place.
That's right.
We want to get some response to a cutting letter President Trump was sent from a highly respected military leader, retired Admiral William McRaven. McRaven oversaw the Navy SEAL raid that killed Osama bin Laden. The open letter was published in the Washington Post. In it, McRaven asks Trump to revoke his security clearance, just as he revoked the clearance for the former head of the CIA, John Brennan. President Trump said he had to revoke the clearance because of what he calls the rigged investigation of Russian election meddling. Jason Dempsey is a retired Army officer and author of the book Our Army, Soldiers, Politics, and American Civil-Military Relations. Jason, several high-ranking former officials have criticized President Trump for revoking security clearances. You say McRaven's letter in response is unique. Why?
So what makes this unique is that you've got, as you mentioned, a highly respected former military leader who really has no identity other than senior Navy SEAL commander. And at the moment, we're in a position in America where there's really only one national institution standing that has the trust and confidence of the American people, and that's the American military. Now, a lot of folks who've criticized before with military experience, they've come out and criticized Trump maybe after they've made political views known or after they've kind of entered the arena for a while. What's unique about McRaven is he's kept his powder dry and his cards kind of close to his chest. And again, most people don't see him as anything other than a highly respected Navy admiral. So for him to come out and to come out so strongly, you know, the question is, is this a McCarthy Welch moment when the senior counsel to the U.S. Army in the midst of the McCarthy hearing said, you know, finally, sir, do you have no sense of decency? Of course, that episode seems wildly quaint when you compare it to the invective and political discourse today. But that was the beginning of the downfall of McCarthy. And it's interesting that McRaven mentioned McCarthy in his letter because there might be some parallels here where this finally breaks the dam, whereas other criticisms haven't.
Yeah, in the letter the McRaven sends, it says, if you think for a moment, this is to the president, if you think for a moment that your McCarthy-era tactics will suppress the voices of criticism, you're sadly mistaken. The criticism will continue until you become the leader we prayed you would be. What's the upshot for civilian military relations? This is something that you have studied. I mean, how? Mm-hmm. What does any of this matter in the bigger picture?
It used to be that politics stops at the water's edge. Right? That was kind of the Cold War consensus between the two parties. There was a recognition and an agreement that the Soviet Union back then was the enemy, everybody was on board, and people wouldn't snipe each other at each other politically when it came to issues of national security. That concept was buried long ago, and this is certainly one of, if not the last, among the last nails in that coffin, right? Now everything is partisan. Everything is political. And so now it's going to be interesting to talk, well, how do we come to – we're entering a period of vast disagreement even about how to approach our friends and enemies, and it's going to take a little while for that to shake out.
So we're talking about military-civilian relations and the consequences of something like this. What happens within the military? I mean, the military, you know, operates under a hierarchy, yeah, but there are various opinions within the military itself, left or right or somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. How does this kind of thing play out there?
And so that's what we've always been afraid of, and, you know, those of us in the military and those of us who study civil-military relations, is this idea that once senior leaders, even if they're retired, jump directly into the partisan fray, that cascades down into the force. And what we don't want to see, or what most of us fear, is this idea that you would start having a partisan military, or where partisan identification would become something that politicians take into account at lower and lower levels of promotion. If one side is saying that this president is absolutely incapable of leading the force, you know, then you're going to have a further self-selection of people who want to enter into the military. It has a whole host of cascading issues, including what's legal, what orders do you follow, and what's in the best interest of America.
Something like this that's happening at the highest ranks, you think could have an impact on the lower ranks in the military, even to the extent of who's going to sign up?
Oh, absolutely. So if the military becomes seen as an increasingly partisan institution, and there's some evidence out there in the scholarship that it is seen a little bit that way.
Partisan toward which way?
Republicans at the moment, although it's much more balanced. My research and evidence shows the military largely reflects the American population in terms of political ideology, but because of the actions of a lot of senior officers throughout the 90s and 2000s, there's a perception that the entire force kind of leans Republican. And so what you do is you get a feedback effect where somebody who thinks, hey, maybe I want to join, but you know, maybe I'm not all in on one specific ideology, maybe I don't want to go hang out with folks like that. It's easy to see how military officers getting involved, recently retired military officers getting involved in debates like this, can influence how senior political leaders interact, say, with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or the service chiefs. They're constantly thinking, okay, what's this guy going to say when I relieve him? Or, you know, how do I pick a replacement that won't turn into an enemy?
Jason Dempsey, Senior Fellow at the Center for a New American Security, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.